And welcome, friends, to the Generations Broadcast. Kevin Swanson, your host, with you today. And today we are going to look at the subject of atheism. Seems that atheism has been up and coming for 9 to 2 centuries, at least in the Western world. A Gallup poll that's been monitoring the question for some 75 years, do you believe in God? The answer was pretty steady. Around 94% to 98% of Americans believed in God for some 50 years. And then the last 20 years, that dropped off from 92% to 79%. And here's the latest data I found on Wikipedia. Don't know if it's accurate or not, but 27% of Europeans believe in the God of the Bible. 38% of Europeans believe in some other higher power. And 26% of Europeans now do not believe in any higher power. So those are the stats. Seems like this has been a little bit of an up-and-coming thing for a few centuries. But what's happening? Are the atheists winning? Will a godless education system result in more godless people? And does atheism have what it takes to sustain a civilization? These are important questions. And, well, we have author Eric Metaxas with us today. He's the author of Bonhoeffer, Luther, Amazing Grace on John Newton. That would have been a few years ago. And now Eric Metaxas is making the argument that the reports of the death of God were greatly exaggerated. In his new book, Is Atheism Dead? I borrow from Mark Twain there just for a few seconds. Now we welcome Eric Metaxas to our program. Welcome, Eric. Nice to have you back with us.
It's a privilege. Thank you so much, Kevin.
Yeah. Is atheism dead? You know, we go all the way back to the 1790s with Jeremy Bentham and his godson, John Stuart Mill, and others. And it seems to me that there was a rise in atheism, but has it reached its zenith? Are we seeing something of a petering out?
I'm here to tell you that on this program, we are contributing to the death of atheism because I am convinced. Now, the title of my book, and I should explain it, the title is Atheism Dead? The reason I ask that question is because it seems to me that the only reason atheism isn't dead is because people don't know it's dead and they still think it's alive. The fact of the matter is that evidence from science, in the book Is Atheism Dead, I give a ton of evidence, recent evidence from science for the fine-tuned universe, other things, that is so astonishing that I feel a tremendous pressure to get this out, particularly to Christians, to say, do you have any idea how completely open and shut the case is for a creator God? It has never been so clear. So in 1966, when Time magazine asked the question, is God dead? You could make the case in 1966 that science is pushing God out of the picture, and here's why. Mm-hmm. Today, the evidence from science is so dramatically the opposite that the only problem is people don't know it. In other words, even believers don't realize how science has over the decades piled evidence up pointing to the existence of God. It is overwhelming. It's not even close. Mm-hmm. And so when we ask the question, is atheism dead? I'm here to say, if you want to be intellectually honest, it is absolutely, without any question, it is dead. The only problem is you have people, just like you have flat earthers, they say, well, I'm a flat earther, I'm an atheist, I'm not dead. You can believe things that we know to be false, but that doesn't really make the idea any less false. And I think that it's incumbent on Christians in particular to know that if somebody wants to be an agnostic, great, you can be an agnostic. If you want to say, I have problems with the Bible, I have problems with the Christian faith, that's one conversation. But to say that there is no God, what I say in this book, and I believe I make the case pretty clearly, is it is no longer an option to say there is no God. Science has made that impossible. And that's ironic because we've all been drinking the Kool-Aid that science is pushing God out of the picture. Well, guess what? Science started to push God back in the picture and has now pushed God into the picture so unequivocally that you have to hide your head in the sand. You have to grasp at crazy straws like multiverse theories. But if you want to look at the facts and you don't like the idea of God, you're in trouble because the God hypothesis is, it's not only back, it is clearly more than a hypothesis.
And yet atheism is still pretty strong out there. Research conducted by the conservative-leaning National Association of Scholars, here's the data, that I brought out a couple weeks ago. Democratic professors and universities in America outnumber the Republican colleagues by a ratio 8.5 to 1. Now, that's just liberal to conservative. And I think that ratio has been getting worse since the 1990s. So is it fair to say that the universities are weighted pretty heavily towards liberalism, atheism, naturalistic materialism, evolutionism, et cetera, just basic anti-God, anti-creationistic theories?
Yes. Oh, there's, I mean, is there any question? No, there's no question. Universities are the bastion of this kind of thinking. But it's like, you know, it's like saying they're the bastion of Marxist thinking, which is also atheistic.
Right.
Just because these places exist and pretend that Marxism or secularism or atheism are real doesn't mean that they're real. These things have been weighed in the balance and found wanting. And it's up to us to make that case clearly, to say, listen, we're not going to pretend there's anything to discuss. The evidence has piled up so dramatically. So you want to talk about why you're an agnostic? We can talk about that. But atheism, I think we have to be honest and say that just because somebody says he's an atheist doesn't mean we have to take it seriously. We could take the person seriously. But I think the argument is, I mean, at least that's the point I make in the book. The evidence has piled up so dramatically that it's almost comical that we haven't caught up with the evidence. The evidence just wipes out the idea of atheism completely. I don't know how to put it more gently or more generously. I can understand why people might not like the idea of God, but I think if they dare to look at the evidence and the facts, one thing that I talk about in the book also toward the end of the book. The first part of the book is science. The second part is biblical archaeology, which is itself just astonishing.
Oh, it's amazing.
Discoveries.
It's amazing, yeah.
But the third part of the book, I talk about the unpleasant bleakness. I mean, unpleasant is a nice word. It's almost the impossible bleakness of atheism. Mm-hmm. But when you actually look at atheism as a worldview, the bleakness of it is unbearable. I mean, it's really the unbearable bleakness of atheism. It's unbearably bleak. And the only way you can say I'm an atheist is to not really look totally at what that means. Because what it means is really not something that most people are prepared to deal with. So they look past the unpleasantness. But if you look at the logical extension of what it means to believe there's a world without God, it's just unbearably bleak, depressing. And I think we need to make that case just because it's true.
Now, going back to Charles Darwin, I think, you know, this evolution is somewhat agnostic, not so much atheist, founder of the evolutionary theory in the modern form. He had this hope that somehow all this evidence would show up where life could appear out of non-life and somehow the complexities of modern life could develop out of sheer accident over millions of years. I think he would have been disappointed. What do you think if he fast-forwarded in a time machine and began to see what science was bringing forward, I think he'd be a little disappointed, don't you?
Well, I think he would be a lot more honest than a lot of the people today who are still pushing forward this, you know, ancient, creaky narrative of Darwinian evolution. I think that Darwin, I mean, a lot of what I write about in the book is this idea that you can understand why at one time people believed something. You can understand why, given the naivete and the ignorance and the primitive science of 1859, you can understand why Darwin came to those conclusions. Given the same thing 100 years later, when you have people talking about not how life evolves or doesn't evolve, but how life comes out of non-life, abiogenesis. You can understand why people believed, yes, it's possible. But as the decades pass and you begin to say, okay, maybe it's possible, let's look into this. What does the evidence show? And the decades pass and the evidence overwhelmingly points in the opposite direction. I think somebody like a Darwin would say, well, you know what? It's clear that precisely the opposite of what I had hoped is in fact the case. But I think that the Darwinist narrative, the secular narrative, the naturalistic, materialistic narrative, it took hold so powerfully that people don't have the courage to let go. They are still clinging, somehow hoping that there's a way to make the case. I find it almost funny, the issue of life out of non-life. I talk about that in the book because we rarely talk about that. In other words, I think a lot of times Christians and we argue about evolution, but forget about evolution. Let's say, you know, whether you agree or don't agree or what, just put it to the side completely and let's just talk about how did the first life come into being 4 billion years ago. If you ask a scientist, most of them will say, oh, well, we all know that life – single-celled life comes into existence 4 billion years ago. Yeah, we know. And you say, okay, how did that happen? They don't have, to say they don't have an answer is to put it outrageously mildly. In 1952, when the Miller-Urey experiment happened at the University of Chicago, they had the first glimmers of the possibility of an answer. And you can see why in the hopeful naivete of that time, they would say, oh, as the decades pass, we're going to tell you more and more of how we get from amino acids to the next step, to the next step, to a single cell that's alive. Well, precisely the opposite has unfolded. And there's a guy named James Tour in Houston, I write about him in a couple of chapters in the book, who makes the case dramatically clearly that the more science has discovered, the more it has made it crystal clear there is no way life emerged out of non-life by random natural processes. It's not even something that you need to discuss anymore. It has been overwhelmingly showed. But again, most people don't even know about this. And the reason I wrote the book after I met him, I said, people need to know that science on this issue of life coming out of non-life and on these other issues, it is just overwhelming, and the only real headline is that nobody seems to know what we now know. You know, even if somebody knows it, most people are still going along with this ancient, creaky Darwinist narrative, the secularist narrative. And we need to say, hey, everybody, we just got a news bulletin. That's all wrong. We need to redo everything because what we've been working with all this time turns out science is pointing in the opposite direction. We've got to deal with that.
How do the atheists respond to these arguments? I know I heard Richard Dawkins at one point talk about the appearance of life on Earth and, you know, coming on the backs of little green creatures from outer space or something, which was the non-solution to the solution. But, you know, what do they say? How do they respond to their lack of answers to the ultimate questions?
It's very simple. It's so embarrassing for them that they either don't respond or they resort to ridicule because they don't have the beginnings of an argument. There's nothing to be said anymore. They're going to pretend that there are things to be said. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, when they talk about the multiverse theory. They might as well talk about the flying spaghetti monster. There's zero evidence that there's an infinite number of universes. So the fact that they are stretching in the direction of coming up with that proves that they will say anything except admit, oh, yes, you're right. The evidence and the logic point to the existence of a creator God. It's too painful. Now, listen, any atheist who has intellectual integrity won't say that. But for a lot of them, it's really a religion. They have more faith in this religion than Christians do in our God. It's kind of an amazing, truly irrational kind of faith. Again, what could be more ironic?
You know, Jesus said something. I used this in one of my books a while back because it was so important to me to understand the philosophers of the day and their influence on the modern age and the effects of their ideas. I think somebody once said ideas had consequences, and that's effectively what Jesus said when he said, by their fruits ye shall know them. And it's a sort of seat-of-the-pants way to determine the quality of ideas, you know. So contrast, and you do this in the book, which is very effective. What are the fruits of atheism versus the fruits of Christianity through the centuries?
Well, see, that's another big argument that I do put at the end of the book as I say, hey, you know what? It's time we looked seriously at the record of atheism. And a lot of times atheists like to say, let's look at the record of the church. And, you know, we talk about the Inquisition, we'll talk about the Crusades. Well, I'm here to tell you, others have said it, but there is no comparison. In other words, if you look at the history of atheism. It is as ugly and demonic and murderous and violent and cruel as anything you could even imagine. Mm-hmm. And we need to put that evidence in front of them and say, listen, you don't have a leg to stand on. You have made common cause with the most bloodthirsty regimes. You can't defend this, and I dare you to defend it. And they, many people have given them a pass, and I think that it's no longer right to give them a pass. I think that honestly, we have to be honest, and we have to say the record of atheism, especially state-sponsored atheism, it is horrifying. Mm-hmm. We need to talk about it. We need mm-hmm. to understand that, you know, Hitler, for example, is one example, not a perfect example, but he's a good example of somebody who rejects the biblical God.
Yeah.
And what comes out of a worldview that rejects the Bible and the biblical God? It says life is not sacred. If not, life is not sacred, some life is more valuable than other life. Mm-hmm. And you just follow the logic, and everywhere you look, you see how horrifying it is, what it leads to, the killing fields of Khmer Rouge. I mean, it's just horrible. We need to talk about that. We can no longer say atheism is neutral. No, it has been really murderous and evil. And I don't think that there's any way out of that. I think people have to face it.
And Eric, one of the most exciting studies that I've done over the last couple of years, my studying of Western civilization, was the fact that Christianity opened the way for science over what I found to be three revolutions. First, the 1350s Merton College Revolution with Richard Swinehead and Thomas Bredwardine, and then on into the 1600s with the Newtonian Revolution, and then the 1800s with Maxwell and Faraday. All three critical revolutions to open up an amazing technological scientific revolution for the whole world, you know, as a blessing on the whole world. And then I expanded my study to every single medical breakthrough I could find over the last 250 years, the most important ones per the British Medical Association's list. And I found that every single one of these significant medical breakthroughs came by absolutely committed Christians who had a Christian testimony and all the rest. But I guess my question is, I think you touch on this in the book, why is it that it's Christians again and again come back and they are the real pioneers in terms of developing science and technology?
Well, before I answer that question, I have to ask you, since I have a radio show, have you written a book about what you just mentioned to me? Because some of that I had not heard.
Yeah, I mean, it's Epoch, The Rise and Fall of the West, but it's not just me, it's Rodney Stark. Probably Rodney Stark has done a lot of the research, so I followed up on some of his stuff. But yeah, my book is Epoch, The Rise and Fall of the West.
Well, I need to make sure that I look at that, because I honestly feel that this is the reason I wrote my book, Is Atheism Dead? I said we have to get the word out about the basics. Mm-hmm. The basics stand in such stark contradiction of what most people believe. It's just shocking. And one of those, the most obvious is this, just what you said. There is no question that modern science comes directly out of Christianity, not in spite of Christianity. It's not at odds with Christianity. It comes out of Christian faith. I quote people in my book who are not Christians, who they see clearly that what we call modern science, the scientific revolution, this comes right out of Christianity. So this false division that we've all bought into to one extent or the other, that somehow science is at odds with faith. Honestly, there is nothing more at odds with science than atheism. I quote John Lennox saying that in the book. We need to, and again, I mean believers, we need to recalibrate a lot of our thinking. Even we have bought into some of these false narratives, and we need to understand that God, in His mercy, has a different time clock than we do, and He has chosen this time, right now, to reveal to us things that have been hidden for decades. And I think that the preponderance of evidence that I write about in the book, I think, how is it possible that most people haven't known this? I haven't known it. It's only in recent years that I've kind of begun to see how overwhelming it is.
Amazing.
And I thought, we're going to have a paradigm shift in the culture. I think we're going to have a revolution, a reformation, because secularism and atheism, they're dead. They're dying on the vine. They're only alive because a few people cling to those ideas. But I really think that anybody who's honest, looking at the facts today, you get a dramatically different story, and you've just alluded to it in some of the work that you've done. But we're talking facts. We're not talking about, hey, this is my Christian interpretation. No, 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 no. You don't need to be a Christian to read facts. Facts are facts. And the facts are that Christians have been at the forefront of what we call science. And it's really been dishonest people who have put forth this idea that science is at odds with faith. That's complete nonsense. It's worse than nonsense. It's anti-sense. It's a vile, harmful lie, and we need to know that and talk about that.
Eric, I want to follow up on something you just said. It seems to me philosophy is supposed to answer the ultimate questions, but the atheism of the day is leaving the answers blank, you know, on the test. You know, like, they're not answering the question. It just seems like atheism just simply cannot sustain the intellectual position. And I guess my question is atheism becoming anti-intellectual and more or less irrational or anti-rational?
Well, that is very interesting, because I think there's something to be said for that. And I was actually, as I was writing the book, Is Atheism Dead?, I was actually thinking that what's going to happen, what seems to be happening, and I actually meant to mention this earlier when you asked your initial question, if we understand that the God of the Bible created reality, so if you're kicking against him, you're kicking against the goads of all of reality. You're kicking against the world as we know it.
Yeah.
And if you hate God, you hate every atom making up your own body. You're somehow partaking in something that is self-destructive. It's a spirit of negation. It's really evil. It's really frightening. And I think that you're going to find people trying to deal with this in various ways. One way, which you're already seeing, is where they basically say, you know what? Logic, all that stuff is kind of patriarchal. We're going beyond logic. We're going into feelings. You know, it's Rousseau. I mean, it's all the same stuff over and over again. But you do see how, for some people, logic is distasteful to them, because they're not interested in what truth is. They're interested in, I feel this thing and it's true. And if I have to reject logic, if I have to reject my own body, I'll reject whatever I need to reject. So there's something kind of creepy going on. I don't know where it goes, but it's definitely it's on the table that logic and reality are the enemies of people who are the enemies of God. It's strange.
Yeah. Here's a $100,000 question, really the practical question as we wrap up the interview, Eric, and that is, where do we go from here as Christians? You know, it seems to me there's a philosophical vacuum forming, certainly at the highest echelons of learning, but how shall we then live? Where do we go from here?
Well, I know that the scripture is really clear. The Lord, in his mercy, commands us to rejoice in him always. Not to read the tea leaves and say, hey, it's time to go to the caves and realize we've lost. We never lose. Even when we lose, we win.
If we're
praising him, if we're rejoicing in him always. He doesn't command us those things for no reason. He knows that when things are bleak, I need to be clear in my word that despair is not an option. Despair is an offense against me. Despair is a sin. Even not fighting for what is right and true and good, saying, hey, we've lost, the fight's over, even that is a sin. The Lord says that we are to be doing what is right and fighting for what is right. He'll decide when the battle is over, because I think that there's an instinct that many of us have, a self-defeatist kind of, you know, hey, why are we fighting? You know, we know that we lose. Let's make it easy on ourselves. And I think that that's simply not what God calls us to, that we are called to speak the truth and to let him decide when he wraps it up. But I don't think we're there. And in fact, I think that people who leap to that and say, hey, it's over, we can't win back the culture, we can't win back the country, we can't win back, as soon as you say that, you're giving voice to the devil. And I hate to put it that bluntly, but it's just true. In other words, God decides when he can do anything at any point. And I think, of course, we want to be wise, we want to discern the times, but I really do think that there are many reasons to hope. But when we basically say, there's not enough reason anymore, I'm going to gather up my marbles and I'm going to head for the hills, I'm done. Mm-hmm. At that point, all those people who say I'm done, it's because they no longer fight that we will in fact lose. So we are all on the hook here. God calls every one of us to rejoice in him, to fight for what is right and true and good, because there are people's, first of all, people's souls depend on us doing that. But I really think that when we too quickly, and there, it's been the history of the church. I mean, how many times have we said it's over? You know, we're going to go to the caves, get the Slim Jims, get the water purifying tablets. It's over. It's over. Mm-hmm. The Lord says when it's over. He calls us to fight. There are people whose lives, whose souls depend on us. And I think we have to be very, very careful not to listen to those voices, because there can be a real, there's a wisdom, but it's a worldly wisdom in saying it's over,
right.
We've lost, we've got to prepare our, I mean, look, we should be doing all the things, you know, how do I put it? I mean, we ought to be teaching our kids what is right and true, not because the government won't teach that anymore, but just because we ought to be doing that anyway, and preparing them to fight in a hostile world. We need to do all those things. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we should ignore the bad stuff that's going on, but it should drive us to action more than it should drive us to despair or to sucking our thumbs in a corner or in a cave someplace. God, we disappoint God when we do that.
Right. And I take it as we stay on mission. Jesus gave us commission, disciple the nations, and just stay on it. Stay on task. Stay in the discussion. Stay in the forum. And the world still needs salt. That's the other thing. I think the world still needs salt. And you are the salt of the earth, as Jesus told us. Eric Metaxas is the author of the new book. It's Atheism Dead. By the way, he's at the Road at Chapel Hills out here in Colorado Springs in just the next week or two. So keep that in mind.
Yes, I will be speaking at the Road at Chapel, what is it, Chapel Hills?
That's it.
Yes, I will be speaking at that church on the, what is it, the 23rd, 24th, someplace around there. Not this weekend, but the following weekend.
Okay. Eric Metaxas has been with me. We've been hitting the high points on his new book, Is Atheism Dead? On this edition of the program. Eric, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it. We just scratched the surface, but hopefully it's been a huge encouragement for our listeners.
I hope so. Thank you for what you do, Kevin. God bless you.
This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.